Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Bottled in China. I'm your host, Emily Steckenborn, and this is the podcast where we discuss wine, food, beer, and spirits. And in today's podcast, we're discussing wine with China market expert Dan Siebers. Today, we discuss the buying habits of new consumers, the online wine purchasing, which has completely revolutionized the wine purchasing ecosystem, and of course, natural wine, because we haven't done that yet, and a little bit about how the market is evolving. You know, back about 10 years ago, it was all about Bordeaux, quickly changed into Burgundy, and now what? What are the top consumers in Hong Kong and China looking for? Are they looking for a region, a specific producer, an acclaimed 100-point wine? Dan tells us all about it. So let's get started. Make sure to follow us on iTunes, Spotify, and Instagram at Bottled in China. And you can also check our website out, bottledchina.com, to really learn about a little bit more about your favorite podcast and read up on some cool stories. Everybody, welcome back to Bottled in China. Today, I'm joined with Daniel Siebers, China Director of Cult Wines. Daniel, welcome to Bottled in China.
Thank you, Emily. Great to be here.
Now, your background's really exciting because you've been in China for a long time. You're one of the first sommeliers who was based in Beijing, and you've seen the market evolve. So tell us a little bit about how you got to China and a little bit about your background.
Great. Thank you, Emily. Well, I came to China in 1998 to study Chinese during university. Then actually, wine was always my hobby. It was my side job during college and my internships. I was always a sommelier at fine dining restaurants back home in Chicago, Washington, D.C., Monterey, California. And when I moved to China, I was actually moved here to join an environmental nonprofit. And at nighttime, I was a sommelier at one of the fine dining restaurants in Beijing, and then decided to merge my passion and with my career, and was very lucky to then join the China wine business in 2003 with Summergate Fine Wines, based in Beijing as their area director, and for putting together with also a dual responsibility for building the portfolio and managing the suppliers.
That's great. And I mean, a lot of it, especially you had a great days and glory days at Summergate, because a lot of the portfolio you brought over Ridge, you brought over some really great producers alongside Ian Ford. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about at that time, what were you looking for in producers back in 2000, early 2000s?
Well, it was trying to find a range of producers for the portfolio that could fit the business of today and also try to build the market for the future. So when we were bringing in these beautiful wineries from Burgundy, Summergate at the time was the first to bring in top wineries like Rousseau, Ramonet, also the U.S. wines, Kistler, Ridge. At the time, there was no market for these wines. The market at the time was largely in the domestic market, was for domestic wines. And in the imported wine, it was not at that price level. So those wineries were more about seeding the market. The concept was if nobody brings these wines in, how can there ever be a market for them? Mm-hmm. So that was actually a labor of a long-term vision, a labor of love, labor of a passion for these wines, wanting to show them. But at the same time, realizing that these were wines that probably for a few years we were going to see the inventories not exactly turn over very fast. But at the same time, we believe that this was a necessary investment for the business. And let's face it, because we were just also big wine lovers and really wanted to see the market evolve and focus more on these quality, interesting producers.
So in today's world, we see so many great producers entering China. Actually, a lot of small producers are doing quite well right now, and there's really attraction. So I want to know, what are the biggest things that you've seen coming into the wine market from 2003 until now? What are some huge changes that really are just completely different than what you would have expected in 2003?
Well, I can say that we could generally divide the market during the time I've been here since, let's just say, 2000 until now, into two periods. And these periods are not a continuation of each other. There was a fundamental transition in this market, let's say, 5 or 6 years ago. In the initial phase, the importers that started, some of them, the major importers, they started almost literally by accident. Someone who's doing business here, had factories in China, was a wine lover and couldn't get any, started to import a few cases. Their friends wanted a few more cases. The hotel wanted a few more cases. This is in the 90s with a company called Montrose. At the time, they were dominant in the market. And it was not their business plan. The gentleman who founded the business had export business for packaging here in China. So in these early days, the market was primarily foreigners in hotels. The domestic market generally was not drinking wine, or if they were drinking wine, there was maybe just a handful of local brands, all pretty much line priced at lower price points, and they dominated the actual Chinese domestic market. So in those early, the first 10 or 12 years I was here, we basically were selling to foreign customers for foreign customers. The Chinese market hadn't yet been born yet. Then maybe, like I said, 5-7 years ago, we really see the Chinese market actually being born, moving beyond line priced, a few domestic producers, and really diving so quickly into the wine market. That's what's really unique about, I think, the Chinese culture is, wow, they learn fast. A year here in China is 10 years back home, 20 years back home. And Chinese people have such a passion for studying and learning and education that I left China for 3 years. And when I came back, one of my first experiences was I was at a wine show in a small city in Shandong, and someone shows me a photo and says, where can I get more of this? And it was a photo of Xin Kuan Nan.
Oh my gosh.
In the middle of Shandong, a wholesaler. And it was just like, wow, this is 3 years. And this is the kind of changes we have.
I think a lot of people actually can't even wrap their head around how fast China really moves. And I think that's one of the biggest issues for a lot of people who are trying to enter the market is, and I mean, we see it all the time being based out here in China. You read something about China that was very relevant 4 or 5 years ago, but today is completely irrelevant. And especially back home, something that's been written 2-3 years ago is still quite relevant today.
Yes.
So that's one of the big misconceptions in China is that it really truly is such a fast-paced market. And as you mentioned, education has really boomed. You know, now it's a key focus for the WSET. Then that just puts things in perspective, right? And of course, as you mentioned, it's just people are now, it's been completely changed. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you is within this shift, you know, one of the things that you mentioned is the distributor. How has the distributor changed? I know you touched a little bit on Montrose, but how has the distributor changed in the last 5-10 years?
Well, given that the customer base and the market has completely shifted. So in those early days, you needed to have all wines for all people. So the importers tended to have wines from every single category, major category, a couple New Zealands, several Australians, several French, and broad portfolios and selling to every single channel. You could not survive if you only specialized in one country or on one channel. The market just simply was not big enough. Now, that overgeneralization maybe seems to be more and more difficult to implement. Now, perhaps the most successful models are the ones who specialize, find a niche and focus on it relentlessly. And a niche being two-sided, a niche within the supply world. So choose a country or choose a style, and also a niche within the supply side, your route to market. Who are you targeting as your end consumer or your key customer? The best part of that was in these early days, really, it was a B2B market. There wasn't a lot of B2C sales. It was kind of this extra nice part of the market, but it was never a major focus. It just wasn't that large. Now, in my opinion, when I look at the entire market, the best, the people that are succeeding, the people that are actually able to turn a profit and maintain their organization and build it in this probably the world's most challenging market are the ones who are focusing on B2C and going direct and doing it based on quality and tastings and a lot of interactions and education directly with their client base.
Now, one of the things you mentioned, I think we talked about a little bit earlier before, it was really interesting that you mentioned, is logistics. So I want to clear that up because also a lot of our listeners are based in the US and they have a completely crazy system. Can you tell us a little bit when you say that logistics is key in China, what do you mean by that and what does the logistics look like?
Well, when I mentioned logistics as being the key to success, in my opinion, it's been based on my observations of watching a lot of companies in this market grow and the ones that have struggled. The ones that have struggled, when they struggle, when they sell, it's normally only one reason. It's cash flow related to too much inventory. Now, when you open a wine import distribution company, you automatically and correctly assume that we need to sell and market, sell and market, sell and market. And the logistics is a supporting function to that, but it's secondary to the mission. The mission is sell more, market more. And that often can distract people away from this kind of sword of Damocles, this danger that when you order too much, it really doesn't matter how much you sell. If you order too much, you get cash flow crunched, and then you end up in financial trouble. So China, you have a very long order to delivery times. You order from the winery. They have to sometimes put on Chinese back labels, ship across the ocean. This can be from 3 to 6 months. So your payment terms, if you have them, you're already at negative cash flow months before the stock arrives. So this is where companies get in trouble. They start to grow and they add more products maybe too fast, looking at their sales and marketing again too strongly and not focused on cash flow and logistics. If you could tie up, if there was some magic way to do just-in-time delivery and be somehow near inventory free, which is quite difficult if you're an import distributor, this would be the best possible business model.
Mm. Now let's talk a little bit also about the customers, because you did also touch on that. I know you mentioned that you see that it's changing really rapidly as well. And now there's a lot of people that are getting interested in wine. It's not only government. It's not only used for Guanxi. It's real consumers now that are coming into play. Tell me a little bit about what you think is the future consumer out here in China based on what you've already seen.
Oh, there's so many types. All of them. Future consumer, we're seeing it all develop at, we're seeing a rapid development of all types of consumers across all types of segments. So let's start with the traditional segment. Let's call them generally, let's say, over 45 years old. They're, from my personal observations in the market, I don't see them drinking as much hard liquor anymore. Mm-hmm. There's far less consumption of hard alcohol. Whereas in the old days, it was quite normal to see people having a lot of fun at lunchtime and seeing the consequences on the streets.
Yeah.
That has been both culturally kind of, I don't want to say, it's naturally and been proactively mitigated. And I think a lot of very good improvements in drunk driving laws have really led to a lot of people paying attention to that and not drinking so much. So whereas before, when I'd go to these dinners, it would be a lot. It would definitely be a lot of gangbeis of spirits, and that would be the standard. That is extremely rare. I really don't find it that often. And actually, most of the dinners are only wine. And even when the ones with only wine, half the people aren't really drinking, or they just have barely a half glass the entire dinner. So drinking, in terms of that traditional market, has gone down. Wine has become a much more normal product. Whereas before it was beer, spirits, and juice, I see a lot more wine on the tables, a lot less spirits. Now we have a skipping down to, let's say, under 33, we have this brand new first-time generation in China that a lot of them were educated outside of China. And even if they weren't, they still grew up with an internet that has connected them globally with the world. And they're just far more globally aware, globally connected, and internationalized, even if they haven't left the country. So they're naturally more curious and they've been more exposed to wine, especially if they studied outside of China. They're far more westernized and wine is a much more natural part of their day-to-day life and their social life. They seem to be drinking even less than their parents currently do. So consumption of alcohol seems to be going down just across the board even faster with the younger generations. Not drinking at all has become not that uncommon.
And you know, it's actually kind of funny you say that, because I do truly see that. When I first came to China, and I'll just, you know, share a quick story. First came to China, I remember doing these wine dinners, and the person who was driving us, I know how crazy this seems outside of China, but I'm sure a lot of people remember it. They would still gambay even if they were driving.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very common, you know, and they would say, yeah, you know, 3-4 glasses. I mean, that's fine. I still can drive. And now they will not and refuse to drink. So I do have to give it you know, you are correct in a sense where those kind of clamping down on that has been a huge one. And even a lot of the newer generation does not like the taste of baijiu. So yes, they're drinking less, but they're emerging as a huge, you know, a new consumer base. So that could be exciting to see that there's a lot of demand coming from the younger generation that just doesn't even drink baijiu. And like you said, cocktails rising, you know, it's more fashionable now, wine's more fashionable, and they're not even looking into baijiu yet. So I think that's going to be an interesting segment. Now, one of the interesting things that you also mentioned is that shift, that parallel, and that something completely new is happening in China. Can you talk a little bit more about online sales? And that I think is super key, especially the new generation, how they've adapted only just using their phone for everything as opposed to back home using tablets. So tell us a little bit about what you see as the future for online sales.
Yes, that is one of the most major characteristics about this market that makes it so different than the rest of the world in terms of routes to market. So we had already discussed style preferences and the drinking preferences, but then routes to market maybe is even larger. I would say the style change between how people drink, the transition that happened between my grandparents and their nieces and nephews, my grandparents and their great grandchildren happened in one generation here in China, whereas drinking whiskey at lunch was normal and now light drinking is the norm. In terms of these platforms, it's even the change in those or the advancement of that is even wider, except the fundamental difference is that we in the West have not gone through this yet. They are ahead of us.
Right.
And this is one of our bad habits from the West is to assume that China is a developing country. Therefore, whatever they're doing is somehow in our rearview mirror. We keep looking in our rearview mirror, looking to see where China's at. And in reality, China is about 20 kilometers ahead of us on the highway. In terms of e-commerce, the e-commerce platforms here, the e-commerce penetration in the market is light years ahead of the West right now.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, it's so funny because even I right now, I haven't gone in a wine shop in China for maybe 2-3 years. Whereas when I'm in Europe, when I'm in US, I love to go in wine shops and choose things and look at things. But here in China, I just go online. I know exactly what I'm going to get. I trust the importers that are here. And it gets shipped directly to your house. And you could order wine when you're in a taxi and it's there the next day or that evening. Yes. I mean, that's something back home that you'd never have. You know, and then no one has to sign for it, you know, all these different regulations that haven't been tied up. Also, I just want to ask you, what are the styles that you see are different? I mean, we kind of know this, but how open are people to trying new styles? Because you focus a lot on high-end wines, but I mean, how open are people to various high-end wines that are not Bordeaux, that are not Burgundy?
Well, there's going to be two types of drinkers. Generally, this is a massive overgeneralization, but just to kind of model it, is we have passion-led experts. Their motivation is, I want to discover. I'm really excited about wine. They're learning a lot. They're normally the wine person in their social group that everybody asks if they want to know what wine to buy. That's the person they text. But the vast majority, they want something safe. And they want something, perhaps their motivation is more driven by a social situation. So I want to bring something that I'm going to get, not going to get made fun of for, or I'm going to get respect for. I'm not going to lose face and I'm going to get face. So these two different forces, and we have them in America, we have them in Europe, we have them everywhere. We can call them, I generally like to call them the label chasers. They're chasing the super famous labels and are looking for that kind of predictability and safety. Then we have those chasers. Now the chasers and the let's call them the passionate people driven by passion. They are so open and they're learning so quickly. You know, I thought I used to be a wine expert. I'm not a wine expert anymore. I now am learning from everybody I meet around me, where I thought I was pretty smart to have discovered Mount Etna a couple of years ago. And now I go on WeChat and there's Mount Etna dinners happening every week, it seems. This has become almost old news among this crowd in the market.
Yeah.
Again, I go back to the earlier point about the Chinese culture's passion for learning and emphasis on education and learning. When they get a passion or interest in something, they just dive in and learn and absorb all the information they can. And within a couple of years have read, maybe in 2 or 3 years, will have read more than I have in my 20, 25 years.
Right. is this something that you think is changing? Because obviously the newer generation coming up was very, and you know, as you mentioned, every generation in China is completely different, especially the last one or two. Mm. Is that going to change as people are, you know, becoming more westernized? Or is that something you think China is just always going to hold on to, is like very quick learners and really kind of focused on becoming better? Or are they just kind of softening out?
I think that this passion for learning and the emphasis on learning is really as old as China. It's a 5,000-year-old history, and learning, and that has been enshrined in this culture so deep. I don't see that changing. What I do see is that there was a massive shift from being a very closed country and before the world had the internet and before we had globalization. This current generation of, let's say, the grandparents and the grandkids having light years between them. When the Chinese today that are, let's say, 30, when they are 60 years old, the gap between themselves and their grandchildren will be 1/100th as large as the gap that they have between themselves and their grandparents. I really feel for them, and they have a very difficult time in their culture because they really are not from that culture of their parents and grandparents. And they really sometimes struggle to understand each other. Mm-hmm. They will understand their children. Their children will come from a world that is already globalized, that is already connected, that is internationalized. And they're just not going to have that. It was this kind of one-time gap that we have in this culture due to, well, probably across the world, but even more so in China.
Right, because there really was nothing at the beginning of, and especially there, and now we see it all kind of come all at once, right? Mm. Now, another question I just have is, because obviously you were choosing the portfolio, and I want to kind of dig into that a little bit more, because I think that's fascinating, is finding the right brands for China. Mm. And I want to ask you a couple of questions. One of them is, you mentioned at the beginning that you were planting the seeds to kind of hope that in 10 years, Burgundy would be a thing. 20 mm. years, maybe some cool wines from Italy would be a thing. Because you guys also had like Amino Pepe and all these really cool things going on. Now, is that still a sensible decision to make in today's China market?
I don't think there is any. You don't need to plant seeds. You just have to find the right field to plant them in. The field is already here. No matter what wine, you know, if you had a specialist that only did Friuli, only did Mount Etna. Mm-hmm. I think there's a place for it. It's just finding it is the case. We do have, I think there's not a single winery in this world that can't find its place in China today. That being said, I do talk to a lot of wineries. I've done a lot of consulting also with Spanish governments, with wine intelligence. And normally the first thing I ask a winery is, let's say they're from just recently, one from Switzerland. We want to come into the China market. My first question always will be, are you in London? Are you in Tokyo? Are you in Paris? Are you in the major markets? If the answer to that is no, or not most, then perhaps you need to rethink if China is the right step for you.
Why would you ask that? I mean, let's say if they said no, why do they have to be in every other market before coming to China?
Not every other one, but they should have some experience exporting in those developed markets. Sometimes we have there's this weird effect that I see with some wineries. One kind of example that pops to mind is we can call it the Savoie effect. So Savoie make beautiful wines. They're very nice. How often have you had them? Very rare to run across them, but there's a reason why. And Swiss wines also the same. It's a big ski country. Everybody goes there to ski. If you're a wine producer, you can sell everything you make at €7 and it will sell without any effort to the local within 5 kilometers of production. Now you have the idea that you want to export. So you can sell everything without any effort in this area, but now you want to export. Well, now in the ski resorts in Savoie, who's your competition?
Yeah, yeah.
Now you're moving to London. Now your competition is Bordeaux Blanc at 1/5 the price and 10 times, 100 times bigger name, New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs. You have suddenly the competition has increased. I cannot think of a number high enough. And your pricing no longer makes sense. So there's a lot of these wineries. What's another one that I ran into a few times? Frascati, that really is able to sell all of its production to Rome or most of its production. It's not even, I met a producer in Frascati who wanted to come to Italy or wanted to come to China. I said, well, what other export markets are you in? None, zero, no other country. Oh, so you only sell in Italy. As a joke, I said, do you sell your wines in Florence? And he said, no.
Right. So
and
why
he
China?
He was here in China trying to market his wines.
So why would a producer like that want to come to China as opposed to growing Europe? Is it just because of the stories and the idea that this is the future, so you got to just start preparing for it? Or what is it?
It's the El Dorado theory of the wine business. So in the old days, in the first few years of America's birth, there was the story of El Dorado, the city made of gold, that all you had to do was get to America and you could literally just, all you needed was a burlap sack and you just scoop chunks of gold off the floor and you could get rich. And that's what drove a lot of people to come from, or during a certain phase in the colonization of America, that's drove a lot of people to come over. There is a certain El Dorado myth in China, and I find it's driven by one statistic. It's driven by a population statistic, 1.3 billion people, and that right there alone. It's an emerging market, 1.3 billion people. If only I could sell one bottle to every million people, I could still have a great business, which mathematically in theory is true.
Right.
But when every winery does the same thing, then it just doesn't work. It's not viable. The correct question should be, how much wine in my category and my price point was imported last year in China? So one of the difficulties in managing the portfolio or managing suppliers, it was really about expectation management.
So right.
A lot of suppliers come in, they look at what the incredible job TWE has done, the incredible sales of Penfolds, and they think, well, surely if I could just grab 0.01% of that, that can't be that difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And they can underestimate the work and the amount of time you have to spend and the amount of efforts you have to put in market. Having a great tasting wine is, of course, critical, but there's a lot of great tasting wine out there. Maybe another analogy is aspiring actors and actresses.
Graham, glad we haven't heard that one on this show. That's exactly what we want.
There's a lot of the talent of high quality actors and actresses out there. There's far exceed the demand for movie stars.
Right. So is this why you're right now in a podcast? Because you have a face for, what is it called? What's the saying?
The opposite of a face. I have a voice.
You have a face for radio. That's what it is. That's why you're here. Exactly. You know, another thing I wanted to ask is that is so key. And actually, I just spoke with David Lucas, who's from Wine Australia, and we exactly highlighted that. People look at that and say, China, I only need 50% of them to drink my wine. Mm. I've already made money. And you know what? When I first came to China, that was also my idea. I said, you know, I just need a million to drink it. I'm not even going for a billion. I'll just take it with a million. So I think everyone has that idea about entering the market. I think you're right. I think it's a lot harder. And you did, you know, raise the point of Penfolds. That's 20 years in the making or more. And as you mentioned, it's you cannot get to that status by just shipping.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just won't get you anywhere. If anything, that's going to land you in a warehouse and that's it. Another thing I want to bring up is you mentioned is previously also consumers of fine wines. Now, you sell a lot of fine wines and you've done that for such a long time, being a sommelier, then working at Summergate, which was really focused on on-trade, and then also today. We always hear about this consumer, these rich people who have all this money, who don't care what they're buying, they're just buying to buy. Now, you sell to them. Who are these consumers who are buying the DRC, who are buying the top Grand Classé? Who are they?
They're what they do for business normally varies. They're normally always owners. In the current market I deal with, a lot of them, they're not going to any office. They've made their money through their family or through their businesses. They don't need to show up to a desk anymore. They have their social groups are full of the same types of people. Now, they normally are in different categories, which would be the ones that are more traditional. Let's say they were not educated outside. They're not speaking a foreign language. They got their money. You know, they were part of this amazing, once world historic economic boom that we've seen in China the last 20 years. And then we also have the second generation, the children of those who are, let's say, in their 30s now and are you know, starting their own businesses and trying to do their own thing and discover themselves and find their own market in China. Now, they tend to be as back home. When I was a sommelier in DC and California, it wasn't much different. It's normally people in finance back home.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just people with the money. And, you know, one of the sad jokes I had to say to a lot of people who came to Summergate applying for jobs, and they would come and say, I'd really love wine. I'm passionate about wine. I want to work in the wine business. And I would say, if you really love wine, become a banker.
Right. Oh, no. I mean, I totally agree. And then there's also another thing, you know, if you want to become a millionaire in wine, you have to start with a billionaire. You know, yes. You start being a billionaire and then you could be a millionaire in the wine industry. And, you know, you do see a difference that back home, it's more of the investors that are buying really great wine that have, you know, that are working for a big bank or a big company. And it seems like in China, they own the companies or it's not like they're upper management. They are actually the owners. And I do see that as well when we do a lot of these dinners and events. I very rarely have seen somebody who works in a higher management position coming to these dinners. It just doesn't happen. Is that because they're not getting paid as much as they would if they were in US? So the cost of wine is just way too much? Or is it just because when you have so much money because you were an owner and sold out or something, then I guess wine is what you go to? Or who are, like, how does this all happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would guess that there's not the crazy bonuses and commissions we see in New York and London in the finance sector here. I don't think they'd run by the same rules here, but that's just where they got the money from.
Mm-hmm.
So where they got the money from is one story. How they actually spend that money, I don't see a lot of difference back home and here. There's a certain type of consumer that is buying to impress.
Right.
So in Hong Kong, there's a joke now that DRC, they call it DRZ, as in it's boring, as in every dinner you go to, people are bringing DRC,
mm-hmm.
and it's becoming almost, you can almost embarrass yourself if you bring a DRC. You kind of are starting to look like you don't know what you're doing anymore, and people are bored of having DRC. That's what's happening in the market today.
That's crazy.
Which is mad.
Yeah, we're a little bit disappointed. We're not invited always to those parties.
You know, and well, I love my job right now. Let's just put it that way. I've had clients, for example, who ask me for Screaming Eagle Sauvignon Blanc. Screaming Eagle Sauvignon Blanc is now double the price of the red.
I did not know that.
Just happened in 2018. And there's a reason why. Yeah, there's a reason why. They only make 150 bottles. It's scarcity. So I have clients coming to me saying, Dan, can you please get me a couple cases of Screaming Eagle Sauvignon Blanc? And I'm like, okay, it's almost 5,000 pounds a bottle. And they're like, yeah, that doesn't, I know. And the specific client, this one I'm going to tell the story about, he's an absolute expert. He knows. And he told me, listen, I know it's a Sauvignon Blanc. It's 5,000 pounds. I know it's not going to be that good. But I go to these dinners 3 times a week and everybody brings Henri Jaillers and in Magnum and DRCs. And it's just very tough to bring something in this crowd that you can impress people with and make them excited. Now, when I bring this bottle of Screaming Eagle Sauvignon Blanc to this dinner, most of the people there will know this is a grossly overpriced bottle of wine strictly due to scarcity, but everyone will be excited and I'm going to score points for bringing this bottle. So I know it's not worth 5,000 pounds, but please get me a couple of cases.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Wow. We all aspire to be at that point. I think we've got a long way to go. So this is something that you've been seeing, is that scarcity, especially in Hong Kong, is something that people are looking for. They are looking for the names, but they're looking to stand out beyond the names.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you want to bring something that wows people.
Right.
And wanting to wow people can be a struggle because it depends on the audience.
Right.
Right. And sometimes you don't know who your audience is. So how do I bring a bottle that I know is going to wow a table of 10 people and I don't really know their expertise level? So if I brought a vertical of Coulis Rond or I brought some D'Auvernay, it might just not register. Maybe they've never heard of this brand and then I've wasted all this money. I can't tell them, hey, I spent 7,000 pounds on this bottle of Marisol. I cannot announce it.
Right.
I just have to know without me saying it.
Mm-hmm.
So DRC tends to be that one that you can bring and you're guaranteed that everybody in the room is going to know what it is. Everyone's going to be impressed. But now we're actually seeing, you know, DRC in 2018, still fantastic increases, maybe averages between 30 to 40%. But We've seen increases in 2018 of other producers in Von Romane of over 70%.
Right.
So we do I'm starting to see a shift of, you can almost see the collectors now walking in circles around DRC and Von Romane and discovering new producers.
Right.
So there is only one Grand Cru vineyard that has a monopoly in Von Romane that is not DRC. It's La Romane. Mm-hmm. That's Ligabella. I'm going to get that wrong. You're going to have to edit that out if I got it wrong.
Yeah. Or leave it in just for the sake of it, huh? Depends how much you give me wine. How much wine I get.
How many dinners I invite you to with these investors,
with the DRZs,
right?
Yeah. I'll check for you, though.
And, you know, we can see those wineries really booming in prices. And, again, the people who are really just buying and they just want to drink these great wines at a great price, trying to keep ahead of that. Running away from these high prices.
Right. So that's kind of what we've seen, or at least, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. That's what I've seen a lot when it came to Lafite and all these top Bordeaux's mm-hmm. out here in China. And again, people, you'll see it all the time, you know, who buys the big Bordeaux's is still Chinese. But actually, I agree with that years ago. Years ago, I remember all these dinners. We'd always have Lafite. It was such a big deal. We'd have all these top Bordeaux's. Honestly, I haven't gone to a dinner where anybody brought a top Bordeaux in the last 2-3 years. It's just mm-hmm. not interesting anymore. Mm-hmm. And beautiful, respectable wines, and it's just not a big deal. And you're right. People are now chasing something else. Now, China's very, very like fad orientated. You know, everyone has the newest things here, the newest cars, the newest purses, especially in cities and especially for you in the fine wine market. So what is the big fad now in China? I see that in, as you mentioned, Hong Kong, DRC is kind of done. Mm-hmm. So what's happening in Hong Kong and what are some fads that you see happening in China then?
Well, I can definitely say there's one big fad that worries me a bit and worries a lot of other people in the wine business is this fascination with natural wines.
Really? Now, yes. You're so against this.
Yeah. Well, I'm for and against it. Actually, what I'm for is I wish we could all define what that means because right. there is so many different, when you say the word natural wines, it means 1,000 different things to 1,000 different people right now because there is no good definition. Some people would argue biodynamic is somehow even less, let's say, organic or natural than organic because you can use copper sulfate in large quantities using the biodynamic practices. When I talk about natural wines, I'm talking about zero sulfur.
Right.
Now, these types of wines in 2018, there's a couple of these brands that when you only look at 2018 price increase data, these two wineries went up 300, 400% from bottles of wine that were just 20, 30 pounds to now they're hundreds to a couple thousand pounds. And they were maybe the pioneers or the origin of this zero sulfur movement.
Mm.
Now, I agree and disagree with this philosophy. I think, in my personal opinion, what I think is happening is the producers say, listen, the wines taste better without any sulfur, but they are drinking the wines only in the winery.
Okay, yeah.
If we could ship their wines to New York and back to them, I think they would agree that a little sulfur is necessary. And I've had multiple experiences with these winemakers where they bring the wines and I'm very impressed. And then I order the wines and they are 1% to do with what I tried at that wine dinner. Mm. The bottles that I had at the dinner came straight from the winery and the bottles that I ordered had actually been transported and just can't survive the travel.
Right.
I think that what this is, in my personal opinion, this movement I think is about semantics actually, weirdly enough. If I told you, hey, Emily, can I put some sodium chloride on your food? You'd probably say no. Well, sodium chloride, it's just salt.
Yeah.
So sulfur dioxide just sounds like a poison. It sounds horrible because we use the molecular name. If there was some word that it was called similar to salt, I don't think there would be this reaction against sulfur dioxide. There is more sulfur dioxide. If people are concerned about sulfur dioxide.
Dried fruits, canned fruits.
All fruit juices.
Yeah.
Never have another glass of apple juice your entire life.
Right.
It's bad if you have an allergic reaction to sulfides. Peanuts are bad if you have an allergic reaction to them. But it's not something that is unhealthy for you. And this, what worries me about it is, there is the true natural wine movement where I'm excited by these wines, but then there is a flood of producers following them that are just calling their wines natural. The wines are extremely oxidized, matterized. They're extremely faulty. They taste. I'm concerned that if beginning wine drinkers are exposed to these types of wines, they're not going to get excited about wines. They're not going to want to continue. These wines are quite difficult to approach and understand. They're in a, as a traditional old guy would say, they're faulty. They're completely matterized.
Mm.
And this trend, actually, I was talking to some wine producers, and one very famous wine producer was very angry. Like, when is this going to end? When is this going to end? And it kind of made me think, like, isn't this just the third wave that we've been through? If we go back to maybe the 70s and or 80s, it was sweetness in wine
right.
was a fashion. So
right.
Liebfraumilches and Blue Nuns and candy wine and all the wine lovers were just losing their minds. And then that went away. We all had a sigh of relief. And then we had the over oak.
Right? Over-extracted, over-oaked, everything.
And now that's finally going away. And here we go with fashion wave number three.
Right.
And you know what? And you can see it's just seems to me to just be a natural reaction to the last fashion.
Right.
The last fashion was about overdoing it in the winery. And now, okay, we're going to swing to, and of course, this goes in with our everything in the supermarkets. Organic is this beautiful word. If you just say the word organic, you can charge double for it. And people just go for it. You don't have to work hard at explaining the brand and selling the wine. If I can just put it in front of the client and say, it's natural, which somehow implies that all other wines are unnatural.
Right.
So it's actually a kind of cheeky sales technique. It can be used in the wrong way. Again, right. I'll repeat myself. There's a lot of great producers making amazing stuff at the very pioneer end of or front end of this, but there's a lot of poor quality wines that could turn people off of wine permanently that are following this trend and taking advantage of it.
Well, I mean, I see this trend kind of happening as well in beer. You know, beer, you have a lot of like more, you have sour wines, and then you have experimental with Brett, and then you have experimental with oak. So I think there's just experimental in general because people are now realizing the diversity of wines and beers that are kind of being able to be shared around the world. I do love natural wine. So I'm a little bit of, you know, I hope it's a trend, and I do believe it's a trend that will stay because there's always going to be, you know, that other side of clean, perfect wines.
Mm.
And I do think they're really enjoyable, probably just because I get tired of wines really quickly. So I'm on to the next ones. There's always classics that stay, but overall, I just find the wine sometimes to be just too perfect, too kind of set in a box. And I think somebody kind of did say this in a really beautiful way is that wine's idea is that it's like a box, and natural wine is everything out of the box. It's not a perfect square. And so, you know, but again, how do you define that? You know, and so it's very easy to fall into the trap of faulty wines to be natural wines. So then you're right. There's just no kind of quality assurance around it. And they're really difficult to export. And listen, I would very rarely find a very good natural red wine in China because they are just horrible. By the time they reach out here, they've kind of just, you know, started to re-ferment almost in bottle, and it's not beautiful. So I do agree that the version that we get here in Asia is very different than the version you would get straight out of the winery with the producer tasting in their facility. So it could be one thing. So you do see that natural wine is a trend in China, and do you think it's going to last?
Well, again, it's what's that definition? Now, the definition, I think, of natural wine that you just gave, for example, then DRC is the king of natural wine. This is minimum sulfur biodynamic going back forever.
Right.
Loire. So, but I feel when people say natural wines, they also mean something interesting and different is somehow implied in that. So this is again, like this, I don't even like to use that word natural wine anymore. I just want to say zero SO2 wine.
Right.
But everything
naturally has SO2
exactly.
though. So then you're right back to the drawing board though, because every wine naturally produces SO2 throughout fermentation.
Exactly.
Okay, this is another topic. I can see that you weren't a true fan of the natural wine movement. I had to ask that one. So listen, we're almost up on time. So what I usually do is I want to shoot 5 quick questions to you, and then you have to answer them as fast as possible.
Oh God, I've listened to this part of the podcast. I should have prepared better.
Right. Well, you don't know what it could be. So my first thing is what is one of the wines that you see taking off in China in the last 5 years?
Moscato d'Asti, and that's been something that I always kind of was waiting for a market signal that the Chinese consumer or a certain segment of the Chinese consumers had switched from drinking from what they thought they should drink, like I should have this type of wine. I need to have red and it should be from this country to, hey, I just want to taste. I like the way this tastes. Mm-hmm. And I think that Moscato d'Asti really taking off was just a small signal. It was like a little signal flare getting shot up into the air that the Chinese consumer now is, or a certain segment of it, is purely looking at wine as, do I enjoy it? Does it taste good? Which was a big shift coming in from the first 10, 15 years.
Second question, do you think Bordeaux is going to make a big comeback?
Actually, you know, Bordeaux hasn't really gone away, in my opinion. It really has. It's been around. It's in a different place now than it was. Yes, okay, so maybe the first kind of KOLs and the first people that were drinking wine, they started with Bordeaux. Then Bordeaux became unfashionable for them as the majority of people started to drink it. But, you know, I do a lot of events and I still deal with a lot of top clients. And there's the love of Bordeaux has not, I don't see it falling that much. What I do see is people also discovering Burgundy.
Yeah.
But that hasn't taken too much away. Yes, now there are, I am meeting for the first time a certain type of consumer that says, I only drink Burgundy. That's it. Definitely a new thing. But the Bordeaux market at the top end is still, I don't see much of a decrease. What I do see is that I'm not going to see it in, let's say, the cool fashionable wine bars. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to see it that segment, the KOL tip of the spear. They're, you know, kind of bored with Bordeaux. They're discovering other stuff. But a big chunk of the market is still in Bordeaux and always will be in Bordeaux. We can always look at the London market as a good model. One of the worst, the world's most mature fine wine market in Bordeaux.
Still kicking.
Still kicking. And you know what? I and myself too still love drinking it. It's always a great wine to have.
My third question is, you were a previous sommelier back in the early days. And what is the role of the sommelier in China right now?
The role I wish it was or the role
the
it
role
is?
That it truly is now. You know, black and white, what is it?
Okay, so the way I see it today and is oftentimes sommeliers get trapped into their own subculture where a lot of sommeliers are making wine lists to impress other sommeliers. I wish the sommelier or my vision of a sommelier is your job is to make every consumer, you could every customer, every client, every guest you meet, make them discover wine and enjoy it. Like you do. Show them, get them excited about it, get them interested in it. Don't just make a wine list of esoteric things that only people like-minded would be interested in. Mm-hmm. Still do that, but that's a third of your list. A third to two-thirds should be stuff that is going to get people excited and eventually, maybe later on, they're also interested in this esoteric stuff, but let's get them interested in wine. Let's share that passion with them. Let's get them starting to climb that quality ladder.
Mm. And of course, fourth question is, you know, in China right now, what is something that you think, I know you said Moscato, but is there a country that's not really on the map right now that could kind of start to emerge?
I really think it from the quality and the quality revolution happening in this country and at the price points, Spain, quality for the price. And what's happening in Galicia with the Mantilla grape and the Albarine, everything is just so fantastic quality. And at the price points they're able to sell that at right now, it's underrepresented. But I think it's also underrepresented in London, in many countries. Now, this may be Spain's one of these categories like e-commerce where China leapfrogs us because they have this intense education mind, because they're going to study and learn a lot faster than we do in the West, they might get ahead of us and they might be the next ones to, they might discover all this amazing stuff from Spain before the rest of the world does. Hmm. And we're fortunate enough that we have a nice supply of very specialized, very passionate importers here in China who are bringing in stuff that I would struggle to find in Washington, D.C. I'm able to buy here in Shanghai.
And of course, our last question is, how can we get in touch with you? How can we follow your adventures? And how can we reach out to you?
Well, Facebook, unfortunately.
Oh, the one thing nowhere, that doesn't work in China.
You have to get WeChat, everybody. It's the future. It's all the present. So we're you can reach me at, I guess, my personal email, dan.siebers@gmail.com. We can put it in the show notes, I guess.
For sure. So we're going to have that in the show notes. Dan, thank you so much for joining us. This was such an absolute pleasure. And I'm happy that we could dive into what happened in the waves of changes in China. And also, what is the future of wine in China? As well as kind of what are the different consumers that we've kind of touched on in this podcast. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Dan. Great to meet you.